Cool. And we are live. Welcome, everybody, to Brain Food Live on Air, episode 31, I think. I'm in Hong Kong, delighted to be in Hong Kong. And I'm also delighted that Adam Gordon, my co-host, is not here today. And he's, in fact, been upgraded, significantly upgraded by the three gents I see on the screen there. These are the three gents from Daxtra. HQ in Hong Kong. Sergey, can you introduce yourselves very quickly to the people who might not know who you are?
So my name is Sergey. I am running the Daxtra operation in Asia Pacific. To the right from me is BJ. BJ is our client services director, and he looks after existing clients and is in charge of them being happy. And Kyle Irwin there, he's our business development manager in APAC. He was born and bred in Hong Kong, and he knows the market very, very well.
Yeah, fantastic. So great to have you guys on here. And the reason why I wanted to get you on, obviously, because Daxtra is a globally famous recruitment tech organization. I think there's very few people in the business that don't know who you are, which is quite remarkable given the fact that you're kind of a B2B business. But I've been aware of Daxtra way back since my agency days, when you were one of the very first kind of competent companies that was extracting CV data and parsing it into what was then, we would call it was a database, right? Just a co-located database that we'd have. So great to get you guys here to chat with us about, I guess, recruitment tech and Hong Kong.
Sure.
And you can tell I'm in Hong Kong because construction's going on in the background completely unexpectedly. But this is where we're at, the construction capital of the world. Okay. So usually when we kick this off, we kind of go through a brief review over the recruiting brain food of last week. I'm not sure whether you guys have had the chance to read it at all. But if you have, have you got any kind of comments to make on last week's issue? Anything that was particularly interesting for you?
I actually had a read. Look, I read a couple of them. I didn't get time to read every single one on there. I did find the two that I thought were most interesting for me were the ones about basically AI being able to identify gender. I thought that was quite an interesting article. I read through that and sort of had a play with the interactive tool on there. The other one that I thought was really very interesting was talking about jobs being replaced by robots, and specifically talking about the fishing industry. So talking yes. about someone being able to go around and identify, the quality of fish, but also specifically which fish it worth and things like that.
Let's talk about that, Kyle, because that was actually my favorite post. Yeah. That was actually my favorite post yeah. that week.
Sorry. And
it was the story of basically some startup in the US who's trying to disrupt the fishmonger industry, I think, by cutting out the supply chain. But there's one component guy that actually was on the point and picking out the fish. And I seem to have lost you guys there. Yeah. And it was one of those where I'm thinking, you know what, everyone's feeling a little bit concerned about tech unemployment and is your job going to be at risk? But there seems to be certain types of job that are super niche, super specialized, that it kind of needs the human touch, and I just wonder whether this is just an example, kind of a funny example, but maybe an example of the kind of artisanal work that might still be very resistant to tech unemployment. So I've just shared the link there to everyone. There's a New York article. I definitely would recommend people take a read of it. I don't know what you guys think of it. I mean, you know what? A lot of the tech unemployment stuff, is that a big deal in Hong Kong? Do people talk about that as something that's significant?
I think it's a common worry for people everywhere. But it's funny because at least for us in what we do, we're constantly talking to people about how essentially what we try to do, our software, I'm not trying to plug the software, but the whole point of what we do is to actually help recruiters to do what they do. So specifically, the whole point of it is we're trying to take away the bits of the process that can be automated, and we do still believe in the human touch. So I do still think there is an element, particularly to recruitment, of having that sort of human element. But
In the sort of really early sense, I suppose CV parsing was one of the first automation examples, wasn't it? Because back in the day, you'd actually have people typing stuff in. So what you guys have replaced is the human being taking a paper CV and probably a secretary or some sort of admin person's data entering it into some sort of database that could be searched. So I'm sure that type of role actually existed. So I suppose you're one of the early examples of getting rid of some of that mechanical type of work. Okay, I interrupted someone else who was about to come in there, Cal, so I beg your pardon.
That's all right. You guys want to add?
Just in general, I mean, I think where the market is trending in recruitment and in other industries is where roles that were objectivity is very important are the areas where technology is stepping in. But things like a recruitment industry, there is a clear line between the subjectivity that a recruiter needs to apply when they're interviewing candidates and so forth that you can't get from a document or from a LinkedIn profile and so forth. So there is still that element, that human element that is required. But as Kyle said, you know, the technology is there to remove the need for people to do the objective works like the loading of the data and so forth to allow the recruiters to focus more on those subjectivity and the soft skills.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to add that our objective is not to replace human beings in their jobs, but to simplify and streamline their job, bring efficiencies to their job, and we're achieving that by automating certain routine processes that machines are capable of doing these days. Whereas, for example, other processes such as candidates' behavioral or soft skill assessment, or even like obviously the whole interviewing process, that cannot be replaced by a machine. So at least not at this day and age.
We're starting to see it happen, man. I mean, you guys have started sort of the wave, if you like, but all of the bits of the recruitment process that were once very human-centric, you can start seeing technology companies kind of have a go at it. And that's to some consternation as to people in the industry. And probably, I remember, I mean, you guys are probably too early in the day to, or at least you weren't in the business at the beginning of CV parsing, I'm assuming. But there probably was human resistance to what you brought in at the time, you know, people who were data entry folks.
Yeah, no, that was a good 18 years ago when we rolled out our CV parser the first time. And there was, I wouldn't say resistance, there was a fair amount of, mistrust and cautiousness among people to adopt anything. Like, it's in human nature. We're very cautious to adopt new things. But it became commonplace now. I mean, CV parsing is now absolutely a standard feature of many ATS systems, and we have moved on this technology from just being a CV parsing technology to bringing some automation workflows so the system knows where CVs are coming from, who they should be addressed to, and how to match them to open jobs on the database, all these kinds of things. So the recruiter then goes and we save heaps of times for recruiters to, instead of wade through a large amount of CVs, we suggest the most like highly ranked, highly matched candidates against their open jobs, at which point they take over and they qualify, assess, and promote candidates where necessary.
You know what? I want to just take you back there, Sergey, because you mentioned something super interesting. Because when Dijkstra first came in with CV parsing, there was human resistance. But as you say right now, it's absolutely absurd for anybody to say, "Hey, listen, we should get rid of CV parsing and get people back typing stuff in." Not even Luddites would want to do that anymore. So I just wonder whether you could kind of recall, or if you have anything that you could tell us about how you overcame those initial objections, Was it a simple case of it being more like demonstrably more efficient and that was it? You know, people were just driven by bottom line, or was there any other type of thing that you, other type of rhetoric you had to use to try and get the argument won in the end?
I think it's a combination of several things, but what I can say is we I guess the guys will agree with me, we are very lucky in that the product is pretty solid. It sells itself. I mean, it requires a fair amount of enthusiasm or some enthusiasm, but actually when you demonstrate it, it does sell. But 15 years ago, it was a new novel approach. There was resistance from the market. And of course, like with any disruptive technology, there are early adopters. Once you have early adopters, evaluated the technology and demonstrated that we delivered savings for them, then there is a wave of followers who will look at them and say that, hey, look at that company, they automated, they saved this money, I should do that as well. Now, that phase came probably about 10 years ago, and we're still enjoying that. And now we're also seeing late adopters who are just essentially saying, well, because everyone has it, we also ought to have it as well. So, but the technology itself also moves on. So it doesn't stagnate. We're much more capable now than we were 18 or 15 years ago when we only managed to process CVs in English. Now we can do it in 42 languages and with great automation as well.
Yeah. You know, thank you.
I think we're very lucky in the sense of the timing, because in the early 2000s was sort of the introduction of automation on a wider scale for corporations and so forth. And so people were, because it was so widespread, people were more open-minded to adopt new technologies and to explore the new technologies. And the ones that, you know, because our technology was so strong, you know, we were one of the few that have survived over those years. You know, there's been a lot of companies that have come and gone introducing the new technologies, fortunately we've been able to persevere and with our developments and keeping up with the trends in the market and rolling out improvements, new languages, and extensions of the products as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really pleased to see you guys continue as you are, because I know there's been kind of many competitors that have fallen by the wayside in that time. Very difficult to launch a technology product when you are kind of trying to set up a new category. I've got a lot of sympathy right now with the new product that's come out from Sweden, which is a kind of a robot interviewer. I mean, I'm going to share the link in the chat stream here, so you guys feel free to take a look at it. It literally is an animatronic robot that's going to interview you instead of a human being.
The
robot head, right? And everyone's like got a massively Marmite experience of it. People think the start of the apocalypse. Other people think, hey, listen, this may be okay. But it reminds me a little bit of where you guys were at 18 years ago, where, you know, it was a new idea. It was like, hey, we're doing it okay right now. Human beings are doing an okay job. We don't see where the productivity gain is. Why do you want to do this? And that's still a question being asked of this type of product now. But I feel also that they're going to get that way. They're going to overcome it. Because there's some obvious, in my view, some obvious productivity gains to doing it. It's giving the candidate an additional choice of a different interface if they so choose it. If a candidate prefers to speak to a robot than a human being, I don't see why that's a bad thing not to have as an offer. You know, and the more I think of it as a human being myself, I'm thinking, yeah, I don't want to speak to another person. I'd rather speak to a robot. You know, why not? So anyway, I'd recommend people check out Tengai and Bias. Get yourself animated and angry about that. It's a good one to chew over. It's basically, I think, the story of technology disruption, just rewritten again 20 years down the line with the new stuff coming out. Okay, I need to talk to you guys about GDPR. Is that a thing in Hong Kong? Do you care about it? How does it work? I mean, because CV parsing has got to be one of the main things where data is flowing, processing from one system to the other, possibly from one jurisdiction to the other. Is it a problem and how do you deal with it?
Well, it applies to anyone who stores personal data of a European citizen. So that pretty much covers the globe, I would imagine, where there are databases of candidates. So yes, very much so. We have to be GDPR compliant anywhere, and for any clients, be it in Australia or Japan, we have to basically tick the box and say, yes, we're GDPR compliant.
And further to that, so many countries in Asia, Australia, Japan, as Sergey mentioned just now, and Singapore, that already have, and China as well, that do already have similar legislation in place for the protection of their citizens' privacy. So not only do we have to worry about GDPR, but we also have to be aware of, you know, the regional regulations as well, and we ensure that our products are compliant with those and that the data is secure.
That's a really good point, BJ, and I want to touch on that because it's really important from a product maker's point of view. How do you possibly stay compliant with regional variants of this type? Do you go with like the harshest one and just say, okay, if we get it right here, it's going to be right everywhere? I mean, that's the way I would do it. I mean, how else can you keep pace? I mean, have you got an idea as how you do it there?
Oh, yeah, a lot of them are replicas of each other. What is different, though, from territory to territory is that many countries and more countries are now adopting laws that require the personal data, such as resumes, to be stored on the territory and processed on the territory of their jurisdiction or where they are situated. So essentially, the personal data by many international laws is not like supposed to be traveling outside of the territory of the organization. Territory where the client is situated, or the candidate in this case. So we react to that by heavily utilizing Amazon, and we geolocate our service for our clients to where they are based. And then obviously further to that, we have to comply with various legal requirements for various countries. We have lawyers basically advising us on certain aspects and clients also guiding us into like how this should be done. Just as an example, very recently, I think about a couple of years ago, Japan introduced a similar law. So we migrated all our databases and indexes of our matching systems, search systems to Japan, basically. So that alleviates the issue.
That's kind of like sort of the end of the global cloud and the kind of the emergence of like national clouds, really, isn't it? So, you know, it's interesting that Amazon is so ubiquitous that it can still be the provider, like almost the global infrastructure of all of this.
Yeah.
But it's almost going back a little bit away from this, I guess, at one point, a tech utopia vision of there being a singular kind of unifying global infrastructure. But now it's kind of like broken into more national type of groupings.
Yeah, particularly when it comes to personal data.
Yeah, it leads me on to something we need to talk about because, you know, we're talking about the fracturing of the internet, and this is an example of it. The splinternet is the new view, right? We're going to go to the point where, okay, Europe is going to have a look, an internet looks like this. The US has an internet looks like that. China, of course, has its own version of the internet. How do you guys see the future? Forgetting about Dijkstra for just a moment, but given the fact you've got this global footprint in all of these territories, how do you see the future? Do you see it fragmenting in this way?
Yeah, definitely. And there was a big ruling this week in the EU that the Google actually won, where the right to be erased law is not enforceable outside of the EU jurisdiction. So Google, they've applied an algorithm or something into their searches where you know, people in Europe, if they've requested the right to be deleted, they won't show up on the European searches. But outside of the EU jurisdiction, they are still coming up, and they won that case. And that just firmly cements that it is becoming more splintered, and access to information is being regionalized because of these regulations. And the courts, you know, the legal tools that are in place to sort of protect these laws and to protect the rights, they're also recognizing that, you know, their jurisdiction can only go so far. You know, you can't regulate worldwide. Why would a law? Why would somebody in Japan be, you know, under EU law. You know, why would they, what, you know, if it's not relevant to them, they're not in that jurisdiction. And so you're seeing that splintering of the internet's, you know, the localization, and, you know, with China with the Great Firewall as well, you know, they have their own internet ecosystem there, and they have, you know, basically the Chinese equivalent of all the popular sites that we have in the West.
It reminds me a little bit of, you know, how evolution sometimes works. You know, when all the land masses on the planet were joined together, there was like free flowing species everywhere and going this, that, and the other. But then when something broke off, like the Australian subcontinent broke off, like suddenly you have all of this divergence of local flora and fauna because they were separated from the rest of the world. And it's interesting, as you say, that there does seem to be some fundamental differences in value in terms of relationship with the privacy, relationship with the state, let's say, and that's going to lead to these different ecosystems emerging. Problems for suppliers, right? Problems for software companies.
Absolutely, yeah. We just need to make sure that we are up to speed with everything and we can comply, but we can only react here, I think.
Does it make sense for a company like Daxtra to play the global game if the global game's fracturing? Or is there going to come to a point where you're going to say, you know what, guys, let's double down on Asia because this is where our core market is. We can't afford to do US or can't afford to do another territory because of all of these laws are starting to diverge. Let someone else play there. Do you think that's a decision that you guys might have to make at some point?
Well, I'd imagine.
Well, hopefully not.
I mean, unfortunately, you know, because GDPR and the Japanese privacy laws and Australian privacy laws, they are different. They're differently written, but in essence, the theme is the same. And you know, going back to what you're saying about, you know, do we focus on, you know, the harshest regulation? And we agreed that we do. You know, as long as we maintain that, then we should be able to, you know, move forward with the divergence. Also, we have offices in Europe, and we have offices in the U.S. who Australia. You know, and Australia and in Japan who can keep abreast of you know, any changes in the regulation and the trends in the market, so that we can stay up to date and ensure compliance moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, if needed, it might be that we have to basically operate in slightly different ways in each place, maintaining the same overall, you know, the software is the same and has generally the same impact and the same functionality, but we might need to tweak various things in the future. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. And we are, to a degree, we are regionalizing.
Yeah, that's
true. I mean, we're a small company. We're only 110, 120 people globally, but we have these little regional offices. Our product dev is centralized in Scotland, where we're, you know, globally headquartered. But regional offices are capable of adapting the product to comply with regional requirements. It's not in what we're doing in our space. It's not rocket science. So far, we have been able to keep up to speed with that, because at the end of the day, a resume is a resume. Where we process it geographically doesn't matter.
Yeah,
and we've adapted. I mean, our U.S. office, their practices are different than our Hong Kong office, which is different than our Japan office. So we do adopt more local practices, you know. And Kyle, being from Hong Kong and Japan, our country manager there is from Japan. In Australia, our country manager is from Australia. So we do localize our offices, so that we have people that fully understand not just the legal side, the requirement side, compliance, but also culturally as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, I mean, it's great that I think you guys, because you've already got this global footprint, you've got every chance to be able to ride this particular wave. I think it probably is going to be more difficult for national companies to go international in future.
Yeah.
So it's almost like the ones that are already there are going to be in better shape. And obviously the big global giants like Amazon may still actually benefit from this, because they're still the go-to. But fascinating to be part of that journey and seeing how it all goes. Okay, let's talk about CVs a little bit more, because this is the core of what you guys do. Firstly, tell me, I mean, do you, right now you're processing CVs. Multi-language was obviously one of the first things that you wanted to do with Daxtra. Does it work with, say Chinese CVs? I mean, how the hell are you going to pass? Do you pass that?
We hired essentially linguists. It's a very rare skill set that is required. You need to be a computational linguist. So these people are scarce. It's like looking for unicorns. But in our case, we're also looking for unicorns who are native to different languages. So we have people native from Japan, from China, from like various European countries to be able to help us with the R&D, linguistic R&D, because it's like teaching a person a new language. The software is designed to a degree, literally understand what people are writing through understanding the context. So that's a lot of linguistic rules, a lot of statistical rules, a lot of machine learning, deep learning, assisted deep learning, and all that kind of stuff. So it's capable of processing in, I think, currently over 40 languages to various degrees of accuracy, because obviously the more data it processes in one language, the smarter it gets. Chinese that you mentioned is fortunately for us, because we're in Hong Kong, we have quite a few clients in China, we've trained our systems on Chinese quite well.
I was about to say, I mean, my knowledge of the Chinese script is fairly weak, but I now that I think of it, it might actually be easier to do it in Chinese than it is to say English, simply because I'm thinking there's going to be a smaller amount of words that you could actually use, I would guess. Would you say that's true in the sense that in Chinese CVs, for instance, maybe you're going to see the same 100, 150 characters in a CV than compared to, say, an English language CV where maybe you're going to get someone waxing lyrical and start dropping in references to Byron and stuff like that, where, you know, there's a lot more different contextual type of stuff you got to try and figure out. Is Chinese easier to pass?
Oof. that's hard to say, because in Chinese, you know, you have the characters and you swap out a character or change the character, it completely changes the meaning of what's being written. So I think both languages are complicated. They just have different, you know, where the complications lie are in different areas.
Yeah, for sure.
Very interesting. I think it there's the fact that we've got this diversity of languages makes it a super interesting thing to do. But you've got 40 languages out there. Is there a big one that's out that you haven't brought in that you're excited to bring into the Daxtra family?
We're very reactive to clients' requirements. So whenever the client asks us to go, so for example, this year we introduced Korean. Last year we introduced Vietnamese, Thai. The year before we introduced Hebrew, all of that basically was kind of put across to us as a requirement from existing customers. So if there is another language, we would just, it does take a lot of effort, but we have a methodology. It's machine learning, it requires a lot of data in that language. So once you have that data and you have the necessary skill set, then it's just following our methodology that then allows us to train the engine to do the job.
We're very lucky in that we've been able to foster and nurture very strong relationships with our clients, and they actually are a big part of helping us with the development of the language by providing the samples and so forth and helping to guide us on the accuracy. And so that's why we engage our customers. You know, we don't just give them the software and say, okay, run with it. We engage them, we work with them, and we constantly look to improve. We're always looking to improve, but we will never claim to be 100%.
No, I mean, I think that's, again, one of the things that's quite admirable about your business model is that you've always been hands-on with the customer and providing a concierge service on top of the software and almost like resisted, you know, the subscription-only kind of obsession that a lot of the rapid growth, you know, rocket ship type businesses have tried to shoot for. So I think that actually leaves you in a very strong, as you say, helps you build those strong business relationships that will sustain you beyond the software. Okay, I'm gonna one more question. I know you guys are gonna do a demo and stuff like this, but one
it's only me, guys. So I guess BJ and Kyle can stay home and talk to you, but unfortunately, I have to dash out to do a demo.
That's tragic for the viewers.
I don't think so.
A lot of deeply upset people.
No worries. Enjoy. By the way, hopefully I'll see you later. If you're for a beer later, Sergey, then we can.
We're waiting for you here when we finish.
Cool. I'll shoot over once this is finished.
Okay,
fantastic.
Cool. Bye.
Good luck with the demo, Sergey. Don't blow it. Okay. That's great stuff, guys. Hey, listen, I'm going to bring on, now that Sergey's gone, perfect timing, because I'm going to bring on another guest on a separate screen. I think this chap is actually in Lantau Island right now. A friend of mine who I met last time I was here, a really smart chap who does a lot of work in terms of organizational development, management consulting, culture, and that type of stuff. So let's get him into the mix. This is Dr. Richard Clayden. Let me see if he's there. He said he was playing squash with his kids. So I fully expect him to be probably inappropriately attired, I guess. I expect a headband at least, you know. If he's not sweating away John McEnroe's brow, I wouldn't be too happy. Oh crap. I actually have to take this call. It's really embarrassing. It's my cousin, it's my cousin in London, but bear with me. Steve, what's up, man? Yep. Right. We need to make the appointment for the area manager. Is that right? Well, right now. Contacted there. The guy's not allowing access to the shop. Is that the scenario? Right. Okay. Don't worry. I'll deal with that. Let me call them in about half an hour. Yep. Is he still there? He's going to have to go anyway. We have to rebook it. There's nothing we can do. Yep, I'll put a call in after in about half an hour, mate. All right, sorry, mate. All right, catch you later. Bye. Wow, I wouldn't have taken that call otherwise, but it's my poor cousin who is in my flat in London right now. He's in there basically. Steve, sorry, mate. He's in there basically to look after the frogs. They have some frogs and they need to be fed because I'm in Hong Kong. They're going to die if no one feeds the frogs. But he's got no internet. Because it's my account with the telecoms provider, basically the telecoms company needs to speak to me in order to arrange an engineer, and the engineer needs to go to the basement, which I don't own or have any access to, and I've got to call this manager. Complete nightmare. So I'm going to have to do that later tonight. Anyway, Richard, sorry for keeping you on hold there. I would not. The only phone I ever answer is my mum or an emergency like this. So anyway, that's down. Richard, how are you doing? Good to see you, sir. Long time. Been a year or so, I think, since we last caught up properly. So good to see you looking fit and well, sir.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I'm feeling reasonably fit, yeah. It was tennis rather than squash, and I'm the other side of Hong Kong. I'm in TKO rather than Lantau, but it was a reasonably okay introduction.
Right, fantastic. Why don't you introduce yourself? Testing professionally, don't you, Richard?
I try to, yeah. I call myself a transdisciplinary behavioral strategist and an organizational misbehaviorist. Lots of long words. So basically what we try to do, or what I and the various people I work with around the world try to do is look at all the various different tenets of organizational behavior. So that the classic the classic disciplines like psychology, social psychology, and anthropology and sociology, etc. Management sciences, so leadership, change, organizational development, these kind of things, strategy, and some non-traditional bits and bobs such as drama or art, and combine them to try and explain why humans are behaving the way they do in organizations. And then sort of look at the reality of reported living in lots of organizations, which isn't very good. There's about two-thirds to sort of three-quarters of people reporting that their organizational life is full of distrust and distraction, and they're having a bad time. So we try to explain that, and then we try and fix it.
You know what, this is actually something that companies are caring about more and more, aren't they? When they're talking about staff disaffection, lack of happiness in the office, leading to retention issues, performance issues, mental health issues. I don't know whether mental health is a topic of conversation in Hong Kong. It certainly is in the UK and places of that type. It might take a little bit of further time, I guess, to percolate in different parts of the world. But I think, I don't know, companies seem to be moving away from that, you know, a macho type of feeling of, you know, suck it up and just get on with it, to the point of really trying to care about people's, you know, well-being in order for them to be happy and productive. I don't know whether you see like a any kind of geographical divide there, Richard. Have you got any views on that? Is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly less discussion around it here than around mental health than there would be in the West. But it looks like from the data that countries that have digitally transformed the most are the ones that are having the most serious conversations about this. And I think Hong Kong and a lot of the rest of APAC and Asia, and they haven't transformed as much as the West, so they're going to be lagging behind a little bit in these discussions. And really it's because I was listening to your conversation early on. The way technology has got into the workplace, firstly, there's the anxiety that you might be losing your job because technology is going to take away all the routine tasks. But perhaps more problematically, it's the fact we haven't adapted to mobile tech very well. You know, most of our lives are spent getting interrupted by emails and text messages, and we're connected to work 24/7 because we have 24/7 internet access, and everyone's got 4G and soon to have 5G phones. So your tech is constantly getting in the way of your life and connecting you to work all the time, and it's driving work intensity and the lack of ability to relax. So there's the anxiety about losing your job, plus the inability to deal with tech, and you put those sort of together. So you're responding to tech, and you're trying to show you're always at work in case you do lose your job because you're not answering, and that spirals into some really quite significantly bad behaviors that will affect you psychologically, physiologically, emotionally, etc., and cognitively. I mean, it drives your performance downwards. You don't make as good decisions.
What's the solution to that terrible narrative?
Oh, I don't think we have enough time in this discussion to talk about it. But there are numerous sort of different ways of solving it. So one of the things that we talk about is trying to divide your day into specific periods where you can focus on different types of work. So at a certain point in the day, you focus on deep work. So deep work would be that. The focused, productive stuff that everybody has to do. So are you coding language? Are you coding? Or are you reading through CVs or preparing interview questions? Whatever it is that you have to do in order to that's measured as being productive. If you actually look at interruptions around the day across the world, you know, most people are struggling to get 2 hours of productive work done in an 8-hour day. So if you can break your day up and say like between 9 and 12, no meetings, no internal emails, I'm just going to go in and do that deep work. You're adding an extra hour of productivity, and you're stopping the distraction going on.
I'm going to share a bit of tech there because there's a bit of tech that's actually helped me with this. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether the guys at Dijkstra would be empathizing anyway, but I'm in like browser tab hell. you know, when you're opening up an email, before you know it, you're on three tabs and you've got 30 tabs open because everything's coming at you. And it's just chaos because it just means you've got 30 potential distractions hitting you. And a friend of mine actually recommended me use a product called this, Workona. I don't know whether you've tried it, but it's literally a browser tab manager. And what it allows you to do is simply load in your tabs for deep work. So let's say deep work is a document and that is it. And no email, no nothing else. That's fine. Then you have a communications tab, which is purely about the social networking, the email and stuff like that. You open that and that opens up. And this has been really useful for me because it means that if I'm on, let's say, deep work, I'm logging onto a tab where I can't be messaged effectively. And you can time box away half an hour, 2 hours, however long you think you need. And you can get that stuff done. And then you can jump back to, you know, the chaos of interrupts when you see fit. But yeah, it's a massive problem. But the time boxing, I think, is effective. And thankfully, we've got some tooling to help with that. What else, Richard? Now that you seem to be on a roll, what else should we be doing?
So we divide sort of your complex work into these five components. So deep work is one, and there's formal collaborative work. Okay, so and I think I haven't come across many companies that do this work that do this well, where you have a space set up and you have some structures set up to. You go into a room to collaborate and you're there to answer a complex problem. That's pretty much the agenda. Here's our problem. How do we solve this? There's a very specific way to interact and to have discussions where power doesn't get in the way and people say what they're really thinking, et cetera, et cetera. So you can leave that room with a bunch of things that everyone's agreed on because they've broken down that problem. That's quite different to what I would call connection work, which is something else that everyone has to do, which is literally sit around and chat over a cup of coffee or a glass of wine or something and chat about work in a more informal manner. And you're seeing, so Australia, where I lived before, you saw that happen in the construction of offices and buildings, is that you would actually have all of these food halls and wine bars downstairs, which would double up as sort of liminal office spaces, secondary office spaces. It's beginning to happen in Hong Kong. So within the next sort of 2 or 3 years, you'll see more and more of this happen in Hong Kong, that you'll be able to go outside of the office and connect with co-workers in a way that perhaps you can't do at the moment. So you won't be quite as tied to your desk. So that's sort of one solution that
let me stop you there. Because I really love the concept of connection work. It's the first time I've discovered it as an idea, but that's different from collaboration, because collaboration is formal. It's a framework. We are here to solve this problem. Whereas connection, there's no agenda necessarily, but it's literally about the information that flows when you're having a more informal chat that might actually educate you about the business a little bit more and you know, improve your general literacy as to what the company needs to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So it sort of comes out more and more of the sort of social network analysis work from MIT and what they call collaboration work. When they say collaborative practice equals better levels of productivity, they're actually talking about connection work. They're talking about having a whole team sit around a table and eat lunch together. And it's the kind of conversations that you would have during a 1 hour lunch break with the whole team there. So someone at one end of the team might be struggling with a problem. And someone at the other end of the table has already discovered the answer to that problem, because communication doesn't happen because they're sitting in front of computers the whole time. That doesn't filter through the team. So in having a regular lunch together, you start finding out how everybody's solving stuff and knowledge flows across a team and everyone starts performing better. You can formalize that in different ways as well, but that lies at the core of what a lot of the science is saying. Collaborative practice equals better productivity. It's actually connection, not formal collaborative practice.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than forcing people into a room to brainstorm. What the hell happens out of that? Nothing but some chest beating from some alpha males. It ends up being a social performance rather than anything, you know, genuinely collaborative. Mm-hmm. But I really love this idea of having a way in which you kind of mix the networks together a little bit. I mean, even in a company as small as Daxtra, you've got 120 people in there, guys. Is that right? You know, I wonder whether it's small enough for it all to for a lot of connection work, but you end up inevitably talking with people that are functionally proximate to you more than people that are at a different part of the business, I guess. You know, if you're working on BD, you're going to be talking with people that are associated with BD, with marketing, let's say, or with sales a little bit more, and maybe not so much with tech, or maybe not so much with whatever. And it may be a way or a reason to kind of shake that up a little bit sometimes and connect people that are disconnected, I guess. That's what connection work is, I think. Isn't it, Rishi?
Yeah, well, we're very lucky where actually we do, I mean, I'm working client services, Kyle's in business development. We have regular interactions with our tech teams, with, you know, people in other, not just in Hong Kong, but also globally. You know, I feel very comfortable picking up the phone and calling a colleague in Tokyo or in the United States or UK. Or Australia, without, you know, there's no hesitation, and you know, we're on basically the attitude is we're on the same team, and you know, it doesn't matter what division we're in. I'm comfortable picking up the phone to call our development team, our research and development team, our support, our CEO, even our global CEO and CTO. You know, we can, you know, I feel very comfortable talking to them, and raising issues and you know, and brainstorming or troubleshooting situations. You know, we're a very collaborative company, and we identify that, you know, everybody in the company has different experiences, and you know, we can learn from each other's experiences, and we don't shy away from, you know, picking each other's brains on you know, how to resolve certain situations, and whether it's technical or whether it's commercial, you know, everybody has an angle that they can contribute and provide, you know, an insight that, you know, somebody, you know, Kyle may have, he's business development, but he may have some insight and some clients because of the sales process that he went through, and he developed that relationship during the sales process. And when they go live, it's my team that takes over. So I'll pick his brain to find out some things that, you know, that came up, that some observations that he's made during the sales process, you know, things that the client has said and so forth, so that it helps my team to ensure that the client's happy and that they're getting the best service. So we're very lucky in that regard, and we also do those, you know, if we want to have a conversation, you know, a casual conversation, we won't go into the conference room. We'll go to the coffee shop and sit down, or go for lunch, and or go for a drink after work, and discuss, and you know, kind of open forum, and you know, no holds barred sort of situation, and that really helps on our day to day. Business, you know, getting along with each other, because, you know, nobody has a hidden agenda.
Yeah, I think definitely, as you were saying, to have a bit of an informal connection and be able to actually, I mean, like, we do things like, for instance, every Friday we all have lunch together. That's just a standard thing across the team, so everyone can just talk, whether it be about work or just casually. But just having that, I guess, just feeling comfortable enough to speak to each other if you have thoughts on something, or that you think you can contribute with something, I think that is important. So I definitely agree. I mean, I worked in Sydney for 2 years. I just moved back, working for Dextra as well over there. And definitely I noticed that, you know, having that kind of, you may go for a chat with someone over a beer or a lunch or things like that, seems much more commonplace than it is particularly in Asia. And I thought that was really good. I actually thought it meant that you could kind of feel more comfortable with the person to really get, you know, to the bottom of what you want to talk about and what actually helps someone. And just, yeah.
Is that, I mean, do you think there is a cultural difference in this case? Is it something specific about Hong Kong or East Asia in particular that might struggle, if you like, to break the barriers a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. I definitely think it is a cultural difference. I mean, yeah, look, it is one of those things. I grew up in Hong Kong, so, you know, I going to Australia in some ways, you know, I'm British by like my parents are British, and so like I'm quite aware of British culture, which, to be honest, Australia and the UK are probably the most similar places in terms, in my opinion, if I was looking at Australia being close to anywhere. But it still is funny when you go to Australia sometimes, like people can be quite casual when they speak to you. I don't know, even like the first meetings I went to, people would speak very openly and very casually, and sometimes I feel like in Asia in particular there's sort of like a wall that you need to break down, and there's a lot of like rules of conduct and and things like that, which sometimes can get in the way. But yeah, I mean, it's just a different way of doing things.
Yeah, Asia tends to look at to be a bit more structured.
Yeah,
and people tend to be more reserved about how they're feeling. You know, I lived in China for a couple of years, and I've been in Hong Kong for 17 years. And you know, the one thing that I learned is that you know, the very traditional people out here will not say things that will upset. You know, they will abstain from upsetting. You know, their colleagues or their friends. It's a little bit different, but from their colleagues who they have, you know, professional relationship. They don't have that. You know, and there's a clear hierarchy where, you know, the boss is the boss, and you don't question the boss's decision. Whereas in the West, you know, there's more collaboration, and it's becoming, people are challenging the bosses more and interacting more with the boss and sharing ideas. And that's coming to Asia in bits and pieces. In Hong Kong, you know, in our company, we're very international. Our office, we've got Canadian files from Hong Kong. We have colleagues from China, local Hong Kong. Sergei is originally from Kazakhstan and spent many years in the UK. And so we've got a very diverse group here in our office, and so we kind of share those cultures and the attitudes of those cultures, and you know, try to pick the best parts of it and try to create our own internally in the company. And it's been successful. I mean, our turnover is extremely low, and we have you know, very good relationship with each other. And you know, we're like a family. We do fight. You know, voices do get raised, but. You know, at the end of the day, it's because we care about what we do and we love what we do, and we enjoy working with each other. And so we do have that passion. And sometimes you do get to that emotional level where, you know, there is, I wouldn't say the conflict, but, you know, the voices get raised, but we always resolve it at the end and move forward. But it's definitely, you know, there are barriers. I've worked in a very Chinese office where, you know, I didn't get to know my colleagues. They collaborated, but as soon as 5 o'clock hit, 6 o'clock hit, they were out the door, and you know, I was another person on the street if they saw me out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting how, I mean, one of the things that I've been doing with Recruiting Brain Food is to try and get some local nuance as to how local cultures affect hiring, essentially. So we're producing these local country guides. And getting local people to basically tell us what it is to work and live and you know, work in the recruiting industry in these places. And it's very clear there's always local differences of this type. Yeah, I think East Asia is probably, obviously there's local nuance, but as a general rule, East Asia probably is quite hierarchical, I would say. Language is very clear in that respect also, how you address people. Yeah. And that obviously leads to certain organizational business structures that might be aligned that way. Or is that a stereotype? I mean, Richard, have you got an opinion on this?
Yeah, I mean, so some of the stuff that I've been trying to take reasonably seriously in the last 6 months or so is the idea that you can divide roughly the business world into Western and East Asian philosophies, where the East Asian is this network of relationships which are all intricately constructed, and you're not going to speak up and ideate, because you doing so will disrupt the harmony across an entire network of relationships. It doesn't mean that you don't have an idea, it's just that holds you back from speaking in a much more restricted way. So if you work with East Asians and you give them an environment where they feel a bit more comfortable and you try and remove the hierarchical roles, there's absolutely no difference. They have great ideas, they're very sophisticated, all this kind of stuff comes out, but it just takes a different environmental viewpoint. So I talk about it being, in Western terms, it's like you've just had your second glass of wine at a dinner party. You're trying to create that flow of conversation, and there's a different set of techniques required to do it in East Asian cultures than there would be in Western cultures.
What would be the technique then? Because you can't be just serving alcohol. Alcohol is a different relationship here. So, and now we're moving into the world also. You know, we count. What is the technique? I mean, let's take it away and serve from culture.
Yeah.
they let down their guard. The inhibitions that they normally would have when they haven't had a drink or two, they kind of let it down. And when people let themselves loose a little bit and around their colleagues, it makes them feel comfortable. You know, when you socialize, you go have a few drinks. You know, don't act silly, but you know, be responsible. But you once you have that experience, then you have a connection with that colleague that you wouldn't get in an office space or in a formal working space, and then that creates a more comfortable working space when you're at work.
You know what, BJ, I'm going to just address that and defend alcohol a little bit because I criticized it just now. I think the reason why alcohol generally has been widely invented in almost every culture on the planet is exactly to create a shared experience. That everyone is kind of on the roller coaster together. Mm. Not saying you go out and get blasted, but if everyone had a beer, actually you're all affected by it in some way. And that's kind of in moment dislocation from reality, if you like. Even if it's just a slight one, it's just a small beer, it still moves you away from normality a little bit, but you're doing it together. And I think that does create some sort of communality, which helps maybe information flow, I guess, in some way.
It probably doesn't even necessarily have to be a beer, but as you said, just something that you have as a shared experience gives you some connection to someone. It could be a beer, or it could just be doing something, I don't know, something unique together, going
sport activity.
Yeah, or something like that. I mean, it's the same way that you build teamwork by playing a sport together, for instance, in team sports or things like that. I don't know if you were having a game of doubles or singles tennis, but yeah, you'd know from that.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of semi-using it as a metaphor. So rather than suggesting everyone has two glasses of wine or four beers, it's the metaphorical. So in the West, you would potentially say the two glasses of red wine at a dinner party, that's when the conversation starts to flow. Yeah. How do you create a similar environment in a Western workplace? In East Asia, it might be the yum cha breakfast. How do you create that kind of environment? And I think there are different ways to do it. I mean, there are. I don't know exactly how sophisticated I am at trying to get people to do it. I seem to do reasonably well when I have a chat, but I haven't really formalized it the way that I perhaps would like to. It's just a different way of thinking about stuff. Yeah.
I think the objective is, you know, what in our office, for example, the objective is not to look at each other as coming from different backgrounds. You know, I don't look at my Chinese colleagues as being Chinese when I'm talking to them, or when I'm interacting with them, or even when I'm thinking about them. Like even now, just mentioning that was kind of I had to think about it, because my natural reaction is, you know, we've worked together, we've experienced, we've gone for drinks, we've gone on junk trips, we've done activities together, we've shared experiences. We don't look at each other as, you know, my colleagues don't look at me as being from Canada. I don't look at them being from China. I don't look at them being from Kazakhstan, from Hong Kong, and so forth. We just look at each other as by our names. You know, and Sergey is Sergey to me. He's my colleague, and that's, you know.
I want to address that point by Harpreet that she's just mentioned in the chat there. She says that it's to do with the size. So in other words, perhaps BJ, the point she's making is, you know what, the fact that you're a smaller company actually helps, is an assistance to this method of informality. Would you say that's true, or are you got an opinion on it?
I previously, before I joined Daxtra, I worked actually for a large Japanese listed recruitment agency. With 1,000 consultants across the region, and another 1,000 consultants in Japan, and the management here in Hong Kong, although they were Japanese, they had very Western not Western, but I would say a mixed approach. And we had the same thing. I mean, my colleagues, I got along with. We had 35 consultants, and I got along with, I would say, the majority of them. You know, I wasn't best mates with them, but we had a very good relationship. We collaborated and we helped each other out. And also similar situation, I'd call colleagues in Japan, I'd call colleagues in Malaysia or in Japan or in China, and I felt perfectly comfortable talking to them. So in the company had taken a similar approach that Daxtra has, which is one reason why I was attracted to join Daxtra, was because the culture was similar. I mean, yes, it's on a much smaller scale, but I mean, we were still able, my old company, they're a client of ours, and I've gone to our office, I can walk into the global CEO's office. This is a listed company. I can walk into the global CEO's office and sit down with the CEO and have a chit chat about nothing. And she'll be more than happy to do that. So I think it size, it does play a factor. It is easier when it's a smaller size.
Yeah, it's undoubtedly.
But it's not impossible for large organizations to create that that camaraderie. And it's about, you know, just how it all comes down from the upper management and how the, you know, it's the leadership. And if you have the right leadership in place that promote that, then, you know, the staff will follow.
You know,
yeah,
what?
It's interesting. Just the small v large corporation thing. That's really quite interesting, because there's something called Dunbar's number, which is if you're sort of less than 150 people, you're quite tribal in the way you interact with each other. Once you're above 150 people, actually you're going to have different. You're going to have natural differences of opinions and split off groups and things like that. And really, that's the big challenge. So to go back to the metaphor of alcohol and civilization, some of the people who talk seriously about Dunbar's number argue that it was alcohol that allowed tribes to grow above 150 people and paved the birthplace for civilization, because it smoothed out the differences. So the question is not necessarily by getting drunk. The question is, how do you get above a certain size, smooth out those differences, and make sure that you have the social connection, maybe, yes. Connections.
Wasn't this what
made all better work?
To run out, I've got a call coming in from a client in India.
Our numbers are dwindling.
Yeah.
No worries. BJ, great to have you, man. We'll catch you later, dude.
My pleasure, and thank you very much for having me.
No worries. Take it easy, man.
Thank you.
So the Dunbar's number thing, I think, is fascinating, because you're talking about, I think you're right. Well, I'm having this discussion actually in the Facebook group right now, quite a heated conversation actually, where people are saying culture fit is BS and all this type of stuff, you know, it's starting going on. But then you're talking about actually at a certain size of business, you are going to have diversity of opinion. No one is going to be speaking and thinking the same way, and you need to deal with that, because you can't have an army of clones. You need to have perhaps people in the room or people in the business that may not be ideally in the same room at the same time, but how do you create at least a unifying structure? Booze is one option. I think religion was number two. You know, if you had some sort of mythic being or some story about the universe that everyone could not prove, but at least everyone could kind of adhere to, then maybe that's a way to create alliances.
Yeah.
So what else could we do in a business
organizations context? So organizations have mythologies that sort of unify. You have your mythological stories, et cetera, et cetera, that get people to even however big they are, people organize around them. So your culture fit question, the people, if you're having a discussion about whether culture fit is good or bad thing, I mean, I think it's probably mathematically impossible to hire for culture fit nowadays, because there's so many different values that are spreading around that if you actually look at the math, if there's 30 values and you're picking five and they're going to be picked at random, then it's very difficult to find somebody else who picks those five, because it's like you have to interview 20,000 people to find someone else who picks the same five values at random. So there's some serious mathematical challenges in hiring for cultural fit. That said, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't have culture. It's just should we be aware that there are going to be multiple interpretations going on. And listen to the interpretations, listen to why people are thinking differently. That's the key. That's what good diversity looks like. And we are united by the fact that we all share the same vulnerabilities and challenges. We're all worried about the similar things, but we all have different tactics to deal with them. And there, no, understanding these different tactics actually might help us do our jobs better, because we're going to come across different ways of doing things. You go, oh, that's a really interesting way of looking at that problem, I'm going to go and try it, rather than just assuming that there's one best way.
You know what? It's very interesting where the culture fit idea has moved and how quickly it has moved. So Harpreet is very much key, and I want to address Harpreet. cultural fit, because that was actually the prevalent view, I would say, worldwide not so long ago. You know, that, hey, it's not technical skills, it's not functional skills, it's actually about whether this person is a fit. And now in the UK, very quickly, it seems that we're getting a backlash against this. And the main reason why there's a backlash against hiring for cultural fit is that you end up hiring against diversity. So in other words, you're just going to end up hiring people that look like you, sound like you, and kind of you won't have a beer with. And in fact, that is not necessarily a fair way to treat this person, and it may not actually be an accurate way to hire this person. So where do you stand with this, guys, in the terms of, okay, cultural fit is, someone said very clearly, it's BS, it's now values fit. And I'm a little bit reluctant to say it's now values fit, because aren't you just swapping the words around? Are you just kicking the same problem down the can? Is the problem really that we're trying to align, we're hiring people that are aligned with us in some way? Whereas in fact, you know, maybe we shouldn't do that. I mean, who the hell knows? I don't hire anybody anymore. And looking at how difficult this is, I'm not sure I want to.
I'm not sure it's so black and white. I mean, I would personally say, I think, look, like Harpreet said, there's probably some element of culture fit. I mean, if someone is basically going to fundamentally clash with absolutely everyone in the business, that's not really going to work. I mean, unless they're conflicting in a good way. I mean, I do think that differences in opinion is a good thing, to be honest, but it depends on what level that is. I mean, if someone challenges you to think differently, then that's definitely better for the business. But I think it's a balance, really.
Yeah, I've got. I mean, I'm actually quite happy. I've got a couple of recruiters that I'm talking to here, because I find it a fascinating challenge. Because as I said, I think it's mathematically quite difficult to find if there's no obvious values or that determine the culture. And I absolutely agree with you that values fit and culture fit, it's the same thing. There's no difference. You hire, if you're hiring for sort of the shared values, that's almost impossible to do, because unless there's just such a small number of values that everybody fits anyway. So what I think is important is that you're hiring for evidence of adaptability and enculturability, people that can adapt to any kind of culture, because then they're going to adapt to your culture because they're showing evidence that they adapt to a culture. So it doesn't really matter what your culture is, at one level. Now, this is the thing that I'm really interested in. So the research that we've done actually shows that really high value in performance in an organization comes from having and knowing who your outliers are or who your wise guys are, or in my terms, ironists, the people that don't fit. They do think differently, but they have sort of an elegant and sophisticated and humorous and light-hearted way of exploring the challenges that
all right, guys, please continue this conversation. I've got another call I've got to take.
I will. You go and take the call. I wanted to ask the guy at the recruiting firm anyway. So how do you know, if that's what high performance looks like, it's finding and take part in
the manager of the shop. Is he there? Just go down and chat to him. Right.
I'll ask that question again when he gets off. I had a conference call last week, and 10 minutes into the conference call, the guys are turfed out of the room because the fire alarms quit, and they've had to go. They have to go and do it in the cafe downstairs. So that was about as interesting as this one.
I had a call with someone in New Zealand recently.
I can't make a call right now.
Because of an earthquake.
So listen,
they're all just going under the table.
Call this person very clearly. So if where you can give me 10 minutes, they'll make a call, and then hopefully that's sorted.
It's a funny story.
Yeah, I know.
Can you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Never work 100%.
Can you text me the engineer's number? That may be one way to do it. No, you need to cut me out. That's the problem. I'm like totally different part of the world. But anyway, as this can't be done for the time being, let me do the call, and then I'll have to pass it back to you. Yeah. All right. Cheers. Thanks, man. Sorry. I know I wasn't muted. I didn't know how to mute this thing, but I had to take the call. Okay. Anyway, just like as the backstory.
So can I re-ask that question, Han?
Yes, you can. I beg your pardon.
Yeah, because that for me was because I would love to talk. I just people who are recruiting seriously. If the high performer is tests as an outlier. And we especially in transforming organizations, I think we have quite a good strong data about this. So an outlier, a wise guy, or there's somebody else calls them trummelers. I call them ironists. Somebody else calls them principled infidels. There's all kinds of names for them, but they test. I think outlier is the easiest way to look. They test as an outlier from the cultural norm, but they also test for having this elegant, sophisticated adaptability to adapt to the culture, to not piss people off, to make people like them, to do, and how do you find those people? Is anybody looking for these kind of people within the recruitment world? Because if not, then we've got a serious problem, because that's where high performance sits.
I mean, definitely that would be the dream. If you can get someone who's able to adapt to absolutely anything, well, that person is first of all going to be incredibly successful. I don't know, maybe, I guess from my perspective, from growing up in Hong Kong as I guess what some people might call a third culture kid, I've always had to be quite adaptable. I have always lived in various different places, in different cultures and things like that. I think sometimes that is probably the key. I mean, I don't necessarily have, live outside of work, the same culture or same values as people in some businesses. But, if you are adaptable enough, then yeah, you probably can go in and sort of figure out how to bring your perspective on things into a business. So I would say that would be great. If I could find someone who would be like that, that would be brilliant. I mean, in some ways that's even better because they're not just, a clone again, as it talks and walks like you, but someone who's got a slightly different perspective on it, but can kind of adapt to the way you guys think or do.
You know what? Just jumping back in, okay. I think there's two things here. I think there's two things, because you can't have 100% adapters, and you can't have 100% ironists either. There's probably a mathematical number or a ratio where that would work. So in other words, you've got a bunch of people that kind of are very good. I think I'm a very good adapter. I mean, in a sense, I've also multicultural kid when I was growing up. So basically, maybe that helped. I can totally resonate with that, Kyle. It kind of teaches you the requirement to adapt, because you're literally thrown in to a different culture, two or three times a year at times. So you have to be really agile in which you deal with things. But that's probably made me a little bit too pliable. So I don't think I'm an ironist in your worldview, Richard, in the sense I'm not a troublemaker. You hire me, you're going to get a good soldier. I'm going to be a good soldier for you. That's a fact. But you're going to need a few ironists in that as well. Now, the question is, I think it's probably hard to recruit both types, but I think it's harder to recruit these ironists, because a recruitment funnel, if you think about it, is designed to screen those guys out. You've got a set of criteria. Someone's listed them. This is what we're looking for. You are exactly not looking to be surprised when you go and recruit. And in fact, when you do get surprised, you get horrified and you reject this person because you think, oh, crazy individual. Whereas in fact, this person could be the decisive factor for the future of your business. So maybe that's I'm not sure any company's got that entirely right, because I think recruitment, generally speaking, is focused on the non-ironists.
I would agree. Just not just recruitment, I mean team building and everything. That person is, I mean, there's some really one of my favorite stories. I'm not really an ironist, but somebody who didn't fit according to, they were working for a software development company, And they weren't particularly good at coding, and they weren't particularly good at Q&A, and they were sort of downsizing, and they weren't, well, this person's not, you know, they're not high performing, and the two things we take very seriously. And then the consultant said, but that's the only person in your organization who's never been on a failed project ever, because she was so good at interpersonal communication and keeping tensions and kind of dealing with conflicts in the team that the team always performed well because she was the glue that kept it together. And yet she was still let go because she didn't do the other things well, that looked something that you could quantify. So that's the kind of person that, you know, that's being seen and as disposable, even though the work flows through them.
You know what, Richard, that's a super important point, because how do you attribute performance in a team setting? I think team sports clearly have this issue and they recognize it a lot. When the star striker snocking in the goals may not be the most important person on the pitch, actually, because there's another person that's actually, you know, making sure everyone's organized and getting their shape right. And I think that's one of the critical problems in recruitment and retention, as you say, is that we can't actually attribute back the functions that people perform in a team setting. As you say, a lot of the fetching and carrying information-wise that this person that you refer to, none of that's recorded in performance metrics. None of it is, but it's super important in terms of optimizing the team and everyone else's performance. It's hard recruitment, isn't it? It's not easy. All right, listen, guys, we're overrunning massively, so I think we can continue talking ad infinitum. It's been a real pleasure getting you both on the show, and also with BJ and Sergey earlier today. But I need to close it off there. So thank you both gents for joining Brain Food Live on air. It's already live streamed into the Facebook group. I'm going to stick it out on YouTube as well as it's going to go out on the podcast, so people who've missed it can listen to the wisdom as well. So anyway, that's it for the show. Thank you everyone for joining. We'll be back next week. I'm going to be in Perth, actually. So I'll be in Perth doing a Brain Food Live from there with a bunch of cool cats over there. We're on the same time, actually same day, different time. So it's going to be, I believe, the 4th of October. We'll be back on this channel. So thanks, everyone, for your time. Enjoy your weekend.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. Yeah, enjoyed it.